Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here. KLDB Club 1220. I guess it's 34 degrees according to the latest reading.
Yeah, it's almost shorts weather.
Oh, yeah, I know, right? It does feel like a sauna outside compared to the last week. Last Saturday night after the show, had dinner, and you're looking outside, and the snow is blowing off the other snow in the wind. And it's like, oh, it's January or November in Minnesota. 2 years ago, we had the first Flashback Twin Cities. I'm sure you were listening. And the first show we did was on the Minneapolis Thanksgiving Day Fire, which will be 32 years ago this on November 26th. So it'll be 32 Thanksgivings ago. And it was our first show. It is some of the rarest video out there. I frequently got calls and emails on this. And apparently I'm one of the few people that actually has this video online. So I want to play, I'm going to read it a little bit here. This is off of Wikipedia, and it's cited here, so you, of course, can go look at this on your own. But the Minneapolis Thanksgiving Day Fire destroyed two buildings covering an entire block of downtown Minneapolis on November 25th and 26th, 1982. The 16-story headquarters of the Northwestern National Bank, now Wells Fargo, and the vacant, partially demolished location formerly occupied by Donaldson's Department Store, which had recently moved across the street to the new City Center Mall. Nobody was injured or killed as a result of the fire, though 10 firefighters were treated at hospitals. The Minneapolis Fire Department quickly determined the cause of the fire as arson. Shortly thereafter, two juveniles were arrested and later convicted of setting the fire using a torch found at the partially demolished Donaldson site. And from what I understand, it was a couple of juveniles kind of living in the former Donaldson's department store, kind of being vagrants inside there. In 1988, Northwestern National Bank, then called Norwest Corporation, constructed a 57 Caesar Pelli design headquarters on the site of the bank building. So where Wells Fargo Tower is now is where the bank once was. In fact, we were having some conversation last night with some people that don't quite know history or weren't alive that period, and I was trying to explain to them that, nope, there was a building there. It burned down on Thanksgiving. The Northwestern National Bank building was built in 1930 by architecture firm Graham Anderson Probst and White. The building was a 16-story, 264-foot meter tall steel and concrete structure. The building had an open atrium through the upper floors, which acted as a chimney for the fire. Those upper 11, 12 stories of the building were gutted by the fire. The bank vaults and safe deposit box located in the basement and sub-basements were undamaged in the fire, but they could not be reached and opened for several days. Due to the severe damage to the structure resulting from the fire, it was imploded on March 11, 1984 to make way for Norwest Center. So let's kind of take a little time warp here. Let's go right back to the next day. This is the news from Channel 5, KSDP, on November 26, 1982. I'm going to play this audio right here. You can also see it on tcmedianow.com, but here we go.
Now, Cindy Brucato, Dennis Bounds, and meteorologist Dennis Belkin. This is Eyewitness News at 5.
Good afternoon, everyone. You're looking at a live picture of the site of the worst fire in Minneapolis history. It was just about this time, 24 hours ago, that flames from the old Donaldson's building on Nicollet Mall spread to the Northwestern National Bank headquarters and then caused some $30 million in damage. Well, Stan Turner is standing by live at the scene of that fire. We will give the latest to you in just a moment. Dennis?
Also in the next half hour, Tony Vigneri will report on a plan to build a $50 million horse racetrack right here in the Twin Cities.
Again, in downtown Minneapolis, for the latest on what's the biggest fire in Minneapolis history. Stan?
Cindy, there's so much noise down here. Wrecking crews have just gotten to work. I can only presume you asked me what's happening. It looks a lot like it did last night. The fire, of course, is under control. Firefighters, many of them remain at the scene right here. Cleanup operations, trying to make sure that the fire does not rekindle. And a wrecking ball has just gone to work here on the 6th Street side, starting to knock down what is left of the north side of the old Donaldson's department store. Of course, more than 100 firefighters were here last night and through much of the night to contain the blaze to the one block area, which is bounded by Nicollet Mall to the west, 6th Street to the north, Marquette to the east, and 7th to the south. At least 9 firefighters were treated for minor injuries. One firefighter is hospitalized with chest pains, but amazingly, the injuries did not get any worse. Now, this is being called the most destructive fire ever in the history of downtown Minneapolis. Fire officials are now sure it began in the demolition side of the old Donaldson's building. Within 45 minutes, it spread to the upper floors of the adjacent Northwest Bank building and raged out of control for 12 hours until 5 o'clock this morning. More than 100 firefighters, many of them called in from off-duty, battled the blaze throughout the night. When the sun came up this morning, the fire was still smoldering. Clearly visible was the damage to the Northwest Bank building. The damage estimates are running as high as $30 million. Now, the Minneapolis Arson Squad has been investigating the fire since it began, checking out reports of suspicious people seen in the area and talking with eyewitnesses. But today, the investigators have talked with reporters and said the cause is, at this point anyway, 24 after hours after the fire,
well,
still not known.
We don't have a cause. We're investigating a couple different possibilities. We've got some street rumors that we're checking on that haven't really panned out. We've got a couple different versions of statements that were made, but the information is enough so that we have to talk to these people and get it straight.
Now, the officials are right now trying to figure out why the Donaldson's fire reached such intensity so quickly. It was awfully fast. But they can explain it spreading to the bank building, the adjacent building. The high flames literally leaped into the upper floor windows of the bank, and radiant heat even ignited some of those office space above the sixth floor level as well. The skyways between the bank and three adjoining buildings received high marks. Those skyways did. Everything worked to prevent the spread of the fire and most of the smoke. Now, the 6th Street Skyway even stood up under the force of a collapsing wall. Well, business as usual, that's what how the Northwestern Bank officials are describing their operations today, quite amazingly. Customers could still take care of their business at the Skyway Convenience Bank downtown or at any one of the bank's 6 branches.
All those facilities are fully operational.
Well, that was possible because the computers which keep all of a modern bank's accounts, the machines that process the checks and transfer money from bank to bank, and the people who answer customer questions, all of those were housed in a different building, the operations center, which is 4 blocks away. There wasn't even any money stored in the parts of the old building that burned. And though no one was allowed into the old building today, bank officials also assured customers that anything that they've deposited in the safe deposit vault is also safe.
Whether people would be able to get in to their vaults on Monday really depends upon the structural soundness of the building.
The fear of your safe deposit box, you put it at the bank to be safe from your own fire, and then it burns down in the bank. But luckily, it was in the basement in these, you know, these safe-proof strong boxes, as they call them, and they were all safe. You know, keep in mind, it's Thanksgiving. Everyone is off. Everything is running on a very shoestring staff from Nome's downtown. And at one point, 85% of Minneapolis firefighters were actually on the scene battling the blaze. The JCPenney and IDS Tower buildings on adjacent blocks were connected by skyways, but firefighters were able to contain the fire and prevent it from reaching these buildings. Smoke penetrated into them, and some windows burst from the heat, though they escaped serious damage. But damages to Donaldson's Northwest block from the fire were estimated at $90 to $100 million, a jaw-dropping amount, but the same as the total of all fire damages for the city for the previous 15, 20 years. The city budget was stressed by heavy costs for the firefighters and police called to the fire and later costs to repair the street around the block. Again, at its peak, 85% of the Minneapolis Fire Department was battling the blaze, with fire crews from St. Paul and the MSP Airport called in to staff and feed fire stations around the city. Now, a couple pieces were damaged, unfortunately. In 1949, the Northwestern National Bank constructed a 157-foot-high weather ball atop the bank building. And this weather ball is of a iconic importance in Minneapolis, and I have a commercial here I want to play and then talk a little bit about the fate of the weather ball.
When the weather ball is glowing red, warmer weather's just ahead.
When the weather ball is shining white, colder weather is in sight.
When the weather ball is wearing green, no weather changes are foreseen.
Colors blinking by night and day say
precipitation's on the way.
Money is a ball.
I like to give you these music so you can think of these all week long. The Northwest Weather Ball. The Weather Ball became such an icon that the bank even incorporated into its advertising and logo for a time. After the Thanksgiving Day fire and before the building was demolished, the Weather Ball was dismantled and stored at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds. The Weather Ball was never restored, and in 2000, it was scrapped. The Weather Ball is gone. The Weather Ball told you, as the commercial noted, what the weather was going to be. I want to play some more audio from this. It was also, keep in mind, the day after Thanksgiving, the biggest shopping day of the year, right after this fire, comes blazing through downtown Minneapolis. Donaldson's department store luckily had moved. However, all the stores downtown, people are working downtown. It was a bit chaotic. And this report here from Channel 4 will kind of explain a little bit about how that day turned out to be.
The downtown drama was distinct after daybreak. For 15 hours, the fire consumed a square block of the city. Smoke signaled the last efforts of the blaze to burn itself out. But towering above the ashes was a Minneapolis landmark. Though charred and soiled, the weather ball stood tall. Its inner light was long gone because of the fire, but the fact that it's still standing left many to contemplate the future, the rebuilding process. The fire story dominates this Friday, November 26th edition of the 5 p.m. Report. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Don Shelby. Ann Rubenstein is in the newsroom right now.
Good afternoon. Other aspects of the fire story we're covering this afternoon include the effects on Northwestern National Bank, what it's doing today to maintain customer services after the fire gutted its headquarters. The aftermath of the blaze left Minneapolis with the downtown dilemma as thousands of people came downtown to see what remained of their workplaces. And thousands of others made this the biggest shopping day of the year, despite the fire. We'll find out how their day went a bit later. Don?
Okay, Ann, thank you very much. First, let's call on Dave Nimmer. He's standing by at the fire scene with the latest information on the spread of the fire. Dave, how goes it, and what is the situation at the fire?
Well, Don, the damage figure that everyone is using today is about $30 million, and mind you, that's not a firm figure. This morning, insurance investigators began to go through the building, going through it floor by floor, and their task is far from completed. And I suspect that it's going to take another day or at least 2 days before they're completing their task, and that figure could go higher or lower. The real question today, Don, of course, is how did the fire start? And the answer is that arson investigators aren't sure. Last night, there were reports of a man who reportedly told pedestrians that he started the fire. The report said he had a woman companion. Today, investigators say there are many different versions of those rumors, and they are trying to check them down. And how much credence they can put in them, they simply don't know. There's a possibility that the fire started spontaneously in a pile of rubble adjacent to the bank building within in the Donaldson's shell, which, of course, was being wrecked. And as far as fighting the fire, well, there was some good luck and bad luck. The good luck was that none of the walls collapsed on any other buildings, and the winds diminished. They were only about 2 miles an hour at the height of the fire. The bad luck was that the Northwestern Bank building was not sprinkled, and the firemen didn't get an earlier warning. It was hoped, of course, that the alarm would be turned in right away. It was not, and by the time firefighters got here, the flames were 80 to 100 feet high. And as you can see behind me, Don, they're beginning to wreck some of the building now. The security around the bank building will be provided around the clock. It'll be by a private firm hired by the bank. And the fire crews will be here for at least 2 days. There are all sorts of spontaneous little fires, mainly in the rubble at the Donaldson's building. So it's quite a scene, kind of eerie. And you can look out, and it looks almost beautiful, which is a far contrast, of course, from the disaster. But the fact is,
couple things come to mind. First of all, if you want to see the video, go to tcmedianow.com, Thanksgiving Day Fire. It's a searchable tag in the website. The fire video, it looks like any kind of war-torn scene. It is, or towering inferno. It's just wall of fire. I mean, picture a story, a skyscraper building downtown just on fire, and every floor has fire and blaze coming out of it. And, you know, picture being a EMT or a firefighter or a police officer being called on Thanksgiving Day. You're having turkey and you got to come down to the abandoned building to burn it to contain the blaze. Plus, every reporter, journalist that's down there. And I'm watching the video here, and it's evening the next day, and it's the slew of gawkers out just hanging out by the rubble and observing and waving at the camera as they're trying to report on this fire. Again, it was Black Friday. I have this audio here. I want to play some audio here.
It wasn't here.
Oops, right, almost here. This is the shopping season. This is also from the same day, November 26, 1982.
A touch of rubies.
I was off the mark, Kyle. That was my fault.
Elegance of elegance from Box Truck Jewelers, downtown St. Paul.
This is the day that cash registers traditionally ring loudest in downtown Minneapolis, the unofficial start, of course, of the Christmas shopping season.
Well, some of the merchants today found that the ring of their cash registers were drowned out by the sounds of sirens instead of shoppers' cleanup crews at the scene of the fire. As Colleen Needles reports, even businesses not touched by the flames and smoke found themselves feeling the effects of last night's fire.
By all accounts, this should have been a banner day for downtown merchants. The streets were packed and people had to wait in line just to get in and out of the stores. But unfortunately, not all these people came to shop.
To see the fire.
Come down to do any shopping?
No, just to look. Just to gawk. Just what we weren't supposed to do.
Did some shopping also. I wanted to see where my old office is. It was on the 16th floor of the building. I'm just on a corner office. And I see that it's completely gutted by fire. We moved out 5 months ago. Thank goodness.
Business was down throughout the area, a sobering disappointment for many merchants who had hoped holiday shoppers could boost sagging sales. The JCPenney store at 6th and Nicollet sustained minor smoke and water.
And there you go. A rough day. Tragic day. Luckily, no injuries, no deaths. Very few people were injured. Some firefighters were treated. Did you know about this fire, Kyle?
I think I've vaguely heard about it, but it's not something that I, you know, it's really big.
Sure. Yeah, I think people that work downtown Minneapolis, and of course, you know, Stan Turner, who was down there on the scene, probably a very, very vivid, very strong memory. And people that don't know the history of downtown Minneapolis, it's a very interesting video. I want to thank Kurt Lundgren for many years ago passing this tape. He said, you may want this for your website. And I popped it in the VCR, and it was great footage. I think it's actually some of the only footage known to exist of this fire from news that night. He was lucky enough, I guess, to be able to have a VCR and hit the record button to be able to capture that. And it's really amazing history right there. Unfortunate, very unfortunate, of the losses from Northwest Bank, but it did give birth, in a sense, to the Wells Fargo Tower, which is one of the tallest buildings and quite an architectural marvel downtown Minneapolis. So we had Roy Findon on, and I was showing Roy, and we were listening to that really fantastic Mary Tyler Moore promotion from Channel 9 in the 1970s. And I didn't think I could, but I think I topped myself with a video this week, and I want to play it for everyone today. And again, this is, I want to put into context here, it is a vintage video. It's not a video, or not a video or song you'll hear during the week here on KLBB. But do you recall Governor Jesse Ventura there, Kyle?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. He was governor from 1999 to 2003. And, you know, what did Jesse Ventura do before he was governor?
I believe he was a wrestler.
He was a wrestler, among other things. But he's always been an entrepreneur. He's always trying to do different things. This video is from 1985. I found it this week, and I wasted no time in posting it to tcmedianow.com. It is, without doubt, the most watched video in the shortest amount of time ever on the website. I have some great video on here. This video, 44,000 views. It's frightening. And when you hear it, it's going to be frightening. So here we go.
There, you can see us. We're in a huge wide shot here. You know who this is over here?
I just met him, shook his hand.
But you've seen him on TV before, right?
Yes, I have.
Well, that's Jeff Passall. No,
that's right.
You know who Jeff is, but sitting with you is whom?
Jesse.
This is the one and only Jesse the Body Ventura.
Absolutely.
Jesse, got to say welcome to you, first of all.
Thank you.
Jesse venturing from the world of wrestling now to the world of rock videos. And maybe you got to explain why you decided to do this.
Well, the first thing I want to say to you, Passall, is how can you dress like that on a beautiful day like today?
You don't like it?
I sure couldn't. You know, I was just out at Fat Cat Beach, you know, out there, Lake Minnetonka.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, where all the fat cats are. And, you know, the water's even kind of purple out there, if you know what I'm talking about. But no, I ventured into rock and roll real quick. I'll tell you why. Because what rock star can be a wrestler? None. But I can be a rock star and a wrestler. I'm unique.
All right. The music video is called Jesse Ventura's I Got the Body. Let's take a look at it.
The Body Rules.
The Body Rules.
I got the power, I got the speed. This body rules, it's the rig, it's my machine, it's my castle, it's my weapon. When I wrestle, I got the hands, I got the moves, I got the ways to get to you. You want trouble, you'll be sorry if you mess with this body. I got the body.
The body rules.
I got the body.
The body rules.
I got the body.
There it is. I got the body. The body rules. Jesse,
what'd you think of that?
I got to tell you, I enjoy watching you wrestle. I don't know about the music video thing.
You don't know.
Well,
you should know by now, anything Jesse the Body does, he does it excellent. I mean, I play hockey, yeah. Prolific scorer. I wrestle, number one contender in the world, and I will rock and roll.
There you go. Are you going to request it this week on the All Request Show?
That was interesting.
Jesse the Body Ventura. I'll take a break. We'll come back with Carolyn Lowe of WCCO-TV. Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with our special guest today, Carolyn Lowe from WCCO-TV, currently at KSBY-TV in Santa Barbara, correct?
Correct, Santa Barbara County. I'm actually in Santa Maria and San Luis Obispo area here on the Central Coast. Good to be with you.
Well, it sounds like a pleasurable place, nonetheless.
It's really nice in December and January, I'll tell you that.
Well, you know, we like Minnesota at Christmas time because it's pretty. The lights are on. It's kind of pretty when you're going to get Christmas presents. But then about January 2nd, it gets old, as you know, from
it does
being here.
It does, but I admit, you know, the people never know. I never get. We were back in August for about a week and did around the state fair and visited everybody, and it was perfect. It made me quite homesick. But I know this is the time of year when we start getting grumpy because we knew the cold was coming. We're going to be standing out in the cold crime scene, so I don't miss that part.
And especially our guest today, Carolyn Lowe, you did the crime beat at WCCO-TV, and I don't mean to embarrass you, for a long time. And
okay, long time.
It started
when I was five, Tom. You can tell them that.
Sir, I thought four, but we'll say five.
Okay.
And I'm picturing seeing you as many years as I did, always at night, you know, the yellow tape, those cold winter nights when, unfortunately, we do have things that happen in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, mm-hmm. around the metro area. Those had to be some cold, miserable nights. You're on the crime beat, but yet also exciting, too, and not in a thrill in a sense that there's anything good comes from crime, but you were very effective at getting very insightful stories and being able to be first on the scene. Do you miss those days at all?
I do. I got very close to a lot of the victims. There are a lot of cases I worked on that stay with me. I still have a picture of Jacob Wetterling, and you know, last week was the third 25 years since he was abducted, and I have his picture on my desk. I have Jody Houston's roots, and they stay with you. They don't go away. It stays with you out, you know, out here in California where we have two murders in the city I'm in now. That's a lot. And so it's very different, but I miss that. I love the amount of digging that goes with a really interesting crime story. And I like stories that are crime prevention where you can make people aware of something and try to have them not become a victim. And that's more the kind of crime stories I tend to work on here. I have a much more varied assignments here, but I like to do things and basically tell people, don't leave your phone in your car, don't do things like that, don't become a victim if you can avoid it.
We were just discussing a few weeks back the Jacob Wetterling piece, and being a person who was about the same age as Jacob Wetterling when that happened, mm-hmm. I mean, that was one of those stories that really hit close to home, because I could have been, you know, why not me, you know, why him,
right.
And nothing is more, I think, and there was a time in the 70s and 80s when the school films were very, you know, they're very focused on child abduction, and then mm-hmm. it's easy, you know, we laugh about it, but then these things happen, and it's real life, and you know, still this day can't figure out why they happen and why we haven't solved these mysteries.
And you know what, though, the thing to keep in context is that I think it affected how we raised our children. My son was five at the time, our daughters too. It very much went in and affected all of us back there at that time. At the same time, I think the thing you can never forget is your real threat is more likely somebody you know. It's somebody you've touched. It's a coach or something. And I think sometimes, like, covering these stories, as awful as they are, and as much as I can't imagine ever losing a child, I think you sometimes contribute it to creating a fear that's disproportionate in terms of, you know, the likeliness of it happening to your child.
The moment of, I think that we can take solace in is these crimes do get solved. I think of the Sackett case in St. Paul. I think of these cases in Ohio where, you know, there's actually people being held captive for a decade.
Right.
And they're still alive, and they come out to tell the story.
And they give hope to people, exactly. And that's why when I look at Jacob's picture, and I have a little statue Patty Wetterling gave me at my going away party, it says hope. And I think that says it all. There's always that hope. And as a mom, I can't imagine you're not always hoping, and you hope other people are not going to forget about it and move on to the next story and move on to the next event in their life. But that's a big part of what kept me going all those years. I kind of feel if you're in reporting, it's kind of a calling, and you feel if you're there to inform people and help people.
When you started WCCO-TV and I'll say the year 1977, and went on the air, did you envision yourself becoming the crime beat reporter for as long as you did?
You know, I didn't. I really fell into it because I grew up in Washington, D.C., where I was kind of interested in politics and news, and I moved out to Minnesota, and I wound up at WCCO, which they took me for free. I called every place in town because I'd always been interested in news. WCCO took me 3 weeks later. They had their first opening, and I was the newsroom librarian and clerk, and I just found, and I would eventually find a St. Paul bureau to look for stories, and I kind of found I really fell into a lot of crime stories and got close to victims. I got to know a lot of police officers, defense attorneys, judges, and made a lot of sources that way, and I was surprised that I fell into it. I love it, but I certainly never dreamed that growing up that's what I'd be doing.
By the way, you're the job that I want to do, the news library, because I think, unfortunately, some news libraries were put in dumpsters over the years, which is why I do PCMediaNow.com.
I'm so glad that you do what you do. I'll tell you a funny story. My first day, I'm lucky that I didn't lose my job. They sent me out to take some magazines to a photographer, Gordon Bartusch, who was at a fire in March 15, 1977. Two firefighters who died. Horrible, horrible story. And I thought it was a little strange to be taking magazines to a fire, but I scooped up Time and Newsweek and showed up at Hennepin Avenue, and Gordy looked at me like I was the stupidest person he ever met. He meant film magazine, and I didn't know that. And I didn't clarify it, and I tell it, I couldn't tell that story for years. I'm so lucky I didn't lose my job that day because, you know, they're running out of film. And anyway, I got back and got him some film, but I tell now young journalists or interns, so I'm in charge of our intern program here, I say, if something doesn't sound right, ask. It's okay to ask. It's better to ask a stupid question than go off on the wrong information.
I'm picturing you putting post-its on good
stories. I survived all that.
Good stories and, like, highlighting things, some good recipes maybe, you know, that you might want to check out. No, that's a great story, and I think that it does show that everyone's going to make a mistake and everyone's going to kind of stumble a little bit on their first days on the job. But obviously, you did something right because you did what, in a lot of TV careers, you know, the lifespan of 7-8 years, and especially coming to Minnesota, you know, not everyone stays here for the great weather and sometimes the other challenges that live here. But did you think that you were going to stick around as long as you did?
No, absolutely not. I had a variety of reasons I stayed, but I think it was a very good life. It's a very good place for us to raise our children, and I knew other people who had a lot of ambition to go to the network and go elsewhere, but what I was very lucky at WCCO is after our second child was born, I was able to cut to 2 days a week, then 3 days a week, and I did that at the same time working the beat at home. I had a separate phone line back then called my crime line. That was before everybody had cell phones, so separate line that people could call me on, and worked on some of the biggest stories I ever worked on. I feel proud to look back and say I did that as a quote-unquote part-time mom on the crime beat, and it was very rewarding. I feel very grateful I was able to do that all those years. Eventually, I went to 4 days a week, but you know, the key thing was keeping up with sources, staying in touch, being willing to go the extra mile when something really big did come down. But then after the big story was over, I could back off and spend time at home with kids.
I think there's a kind of peak in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area of crime. I think that, you know, kind of rolling, you know, from outside the 80s into the early 90s, and I think it peaked about, you know, and I don't use this term frequently, but it's a term that was coined in the media, was, you know, Murderapolis. And
right, that was 1995, actually. Nancy Fizzo and I went inside the Minneapolis police unit, homicide unit, and they let us go in that year that they broke the revenue record at 97, and New York Times called us Murderapolis. That was pretty interesting year.
It had been, I mean, a very challenging time. Not only are you reporting a story, but this is where you live. This is where your community is. And it was, I think people thought we were losing control. I think people thought we were losing control of crime.
Sure.
It was going to just get worse. I think that people thought we were going to fall away of Detroit or other big cities, that, crime was going to overtake what our police force could handle. That, I think that, one, due to, the economy changing, just different leadership, and also good reporting. There's a story that that you did, which unfortunately I don't have video for it. I can't play a clip of it, but there was some of our police force, which you worked very closely with, that were not doing their jobs, and you exposed us to the I-team.
Right.
There were.
It was an interesting story, a very challenging story to be on. I had a tip, just routine thing on the crime beat that some of the officers and the downtown beat were not doing their jobs. And he had a lot of information, but my boss back then gave me the photographer and me a couple days to go out and nose around. And to make a long story short, after we went out and saw some things, we brought in the full, staff of the I-team. Back then we had about 10 people able to jump in, and we observed police officers, two police officers sleeping in the areas, working their part-time job in the middle of shift, et cetera, et cetera. And supervisor of the shift was also working at his other part-time job in the middle of it all. It was scary to do. I knew that everything was on the line. I knew I was going to have to go back and face it. It wasn't like one of those things where you parachute in on a story and you're an investigative reporter, but you don't have to see people again. I knew I'd have to go back. It was tough, but the most rewarding part is I knew it would make things better. I remember watching a little old lady sitting at the bus stop as we're across the street, and she's getting hassled by people. I'm thinking, these people need to be out there protecting her. So it led to some really good reforms. Later we heard we won some big awards. I'd never even heard of before. I didn't know what the DuPont Columbia was. I thought, well, that's nice, but that isn't what it was making a difference. And that's when you feel like you're helping your community and doing something, when you put everything on the line. And I hope at the same time I felt I was fair. I mean, it's a tough story to do, but we researched it every which way, and I think it made, I look back now, I think it made a difference. For a little while.
One thing you see about WCCO-TV, they didn't lose many lawsuits. When these things came up and they were challenged legally, or they challenged the Minnesota News, the news organizations, they didn't lose. I think that the I-team, and I have I-team video from the housing inspector video from the early 80s, which Al Austin did.
That was the first one. I mean, that's when you thought, wow. And there was such excitement when we did something that made a difference, that made things better in the community.
Well, and right now, I think it's tougher right now, just state of media, to do those long-term stories, because everyone's a reporter, everyone's a photographer, everyone is a journalist, and everyone can get a story out there. I mean, facts become secondary, unfortunately, sometimes.
That can happen, but I still hope we're getting people, and I see, I get a lot of hope when I see some of our young interns that are passionate, that really want to go out. They don't want to just be on TV. They want to use TV and the web and all the other platforms to inform the community, and I still see a lot of that, and I find that really encouraging.
And you did something that I don't think, or yesterday, Carolyn Lowe, that I found, I remember when you did this, it was so interesting to me. You became an actual badge police officer. That's something that, I mean, you from reporter to police officer, what made you want to be in that role?
Well, it's kind of like you asked about the crime beat. I didn't really set out to do it. I decided to go back to school after many, many years of not finishing my degree. It's one of the things I never needed, but it always kind of bothered me that I didn't finish my college degree. So when I went back, I decided to get it in criminal justice. I'd originally been a political science major, and I thought, well, I'll learn more. It's a topic I'm interested in. As I went through and went back to the credits, one of the things that I had an opportunity to do was go through something called police skills, which is just a training, a lot of scenarios you go through, and we end up doing some stories on it. And then after I finished all that, I just decided to take the police officer's test, just to take it. I didn't have any plans, and took it and passed. And thing happened, I kept run into Art Blakey, whom I'd known for years. He was chief of the State Fair Police. He said, why don't you come out here and get your license activated? And it just seemed totally off the wall, like it was never going to happen. But to make a long story short, I was intrigued, and I went to my boss back then, and we had to go through CVS Legal and get a bunch of agreements and commitments to make sure that I went off the payroll during all that, that I would never cover the fair, and just carve out a bunch of things because of potential ethical, et cetera, issues. And the plan was to do it for one summer. I ended up doing it for 8, and I think it really made me a better reporter. It gave me a little mini walk in the police shoes. It's not the same as being on patrol in South Minneapolis by yourself or Dakota County, but it gave me a little bit of insight, and I think it made me better. Well, the fair, that's what I did.
The fair is no shortage.
Fun. The truth is, it was fun. I had a ball. I love working.
And the fair is no shortage of challenges, we'll say, for law enforcement. It is a great Minnesota get-together. When every time you have Minnesota's getting together, there's going to be a couple problems that arise. Mm-hmm. You know, we actually had here, we had a lot of, I believe there was some theft going on the state fair, some pretty organized
stuff. Yeah,
there
was a big robbery, actually, this summer. I saw that. It was when I was there, not that night. But most of what we had, what I really enjoyed the most, was we had lost children. Mm-hmm. And I love reuniting your children with their parents. You see parents and kids scared to death. And I remember one of the things I was able to say every year is we've never lost a kid for good. We've always, you know, so you try to calm them down. And it was fun at times. People would come up and stare at me like, why do I know you? And they'd say, oh, are you, you know, you're giving up your day job. And I said, no. And I took, I don't know if you read it, but I took some heat. Some people thought it was a huge conflict of interest, and I, you know, was ruining journalism by doing it. But I said, this was a choice I made. I considered the pros and cons, and I think as I look back now, I'm really glad I had the opportunity to do it. I miss it. One of the things I miss the most is I love walking the beat at the fair, the 12 days at the fair.
You know, the video I saw, you look like you're having a good time. And one of the videos I also saw, I remember the story on Channel 4, and you might be embarrassed with this one, but when you took the tase, that
oh, gosh. That was before I was an officer. Yeah, that was just a story.
I hate to say it, I felt the pain when you screamed in that video.
It hurt.
Just to give some context, when Ms. Lowe was... She had to take the tase herself as becoming a bad police officer, and... Unfortunately, like you see on Cops or CNA, the other show, when you get the tase, it's not very pleasant. And she
it's
did
not,
what any of us
yeah.
would do. She screamed very loud.
Right, yeah. I screamed, but I didn't scream as much as some of the guys did. And
exactly.
I got scared and let it go. But really, and I was proud. I was able to get back to work. They sent a producer along with me for the story. And I thought maybe I'd be disabled for the afternoon. But yeah, I was back to work 2 minutes later. That hurt. You know, I don't think that was as bad in some ways as going through the stuff. If I'm jumping ahead here, stop me, but during the RNC when the smoke bombs went off and, you know, walking around and you can't see and your eyes are burning and you're hoping you don't get in the middle of a riot. I mean, we were in the middle of a riot, but you don't get hurt. That was probably a lot more frightening than the taser.
Do you think that
was 5 seconds. It wasn't fun, but it was over. Pardon?
Do you think that was the biggest riot of people in the Twin Cities, that the RNC 2008?
Probably, it was certainly one of the biggest I was ever involved in. And, you know, it just went from everything kind of kumbaya and off to a great start, and suddenly things got pretty tough. And as I was standing there at Mickey's Diner with Dave Cheney, the photographer I work with, and people are whispering, officers are whispering underneath their riots here at North Carolina, Nicole, you're going to get hurt. And I'm like realizing it's people I know, and I'm just, well, I'm not going to go until we have to go. I'm not leaving the photographer there. So once they declared an unlawful assembly, we did have to go, and we just walked backwards. But it was by far the most frightening thing I've ever been through. But I was back there the next night. You know, I mean, that's in your blood when you do these things.
No, it's, I think, and unfortunately, I was out of town when this convention happened. I think it was probably a good thing, actually. I was out of town for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember watching the video of, you know, of the smoke bombs, and people just picking rocks and throwing them to Dayton's or whatever it was called that week, Macy's, I think that week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that beyond maybe the 60s, which I don't have recollection of, that had to have been probably the biggest mass of people in one spot with, you know, and you don't know who's there to, you know, peaceful protest or who's there to cause trouble.
Exactly.
It's just a lot of human beings there.
Well, I've been around enough things to know that when the stuff hits the fan, I mean, anything can happen. You don't have any special rights as a reporter. And you're standing there, and you just, one of my things I thought about before all that is I remember Julia Sandage, a reporter at Channel 9 many years ago, was caught up in a riot in North Minneapolis, and she got her head clubbed in, and she never recovered, and she never went back to reporting. And, you know, you think you get a head injury. We don't have helmets out there as reporters. You're on your own. You think you can use your wits, and you're going to get through it, but when stuff happens, it happens so quickly, and in the chaos, I'm just grateful that more people didn't get hurt. It's just, you know, something frightening to look back on. Still have a picture on my desk, and I sometimes show it to the young reporters. I think they wonder if any of us has ever been out there on the street. Yeah, so it wasn't all that long ago.
Our guest, Caroline Lowe, is there a moment that you, well, did you ever get injured on the job? And also, was there ever a moment where you really were scared for your safety?
I'd say something like in the RNC at Mickey's Diner, definitely. That was probably the most frightening. There have been some other times when, you know, I've been into prison, I've interviewed killers and rapists, and it's always a little strange when you go in and the door closes behind you. But not a whole lot, not as much as you think we'd be considering what we're around.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to be aware of the environment. But I was not as fearful as maybe I should have been.
You did something in 2011, which not a lot of people in media have the opportunity of doing. Number one, being able to leave on your own terms, leave a station you've been at a long time. If I'm wrong, you could be still reporting for Channel 4 today, had wanted to.
I'd probably be getting November sweep starts tomorrow. I'd probably be working on a crime story or a cold case story for tomorrow, exactly.
But you made the choice to go out to a beautiful country, California, KSBY. What made you decide to leave the 14th biggest market in the country and go out to California and continue working?
Well, the largest part of it was my family. And it was both, a number of things kind of came together. My contract was up. I would have, all things being considered, I would have signed another 2-3 years. But there was an opportunity out here. Our youngest child had moved out here the year before, and she was actually working at KSBY and several other people from TCO. And there was an opening, and Jeanette Trumpeter, who I work with at TCO, mentioned me to the general manager out here at Small World. Our general manager many years ago was assistant news director at WCCO. I think this shows you how small the news world is. Just had a conversation with her and agreed to take a look. And I'd say probably the driving thing initially was the chance to be closer to our family versus another winter in Minnesota with all our kids gone. And also a chance to, I wish I'd done it sooner. It all worked. View of my family to be back there that many years, but I think there's a lot to be said to be new again. I mean, I remember I hadn't been new in 34 years, and things which I had a manual typewriter back then. I remember when I got the BlackBerry 12 years ago, that was like the hot new phone. Things had changed so much. And, basically a new adventure, and now it's 3.5 years later. I never thought it would go so fast.
And what in your role is different?
The other big part was our chance to mentor young journalists. I did a lot of it informally, but in my role here, so the number two position in a small newsroom, it's much more hands-on involvement with our young reporters and helping them.
And your role is different now. You're in management now at KSBY, correct?
Right, correct.
Mm-hmm. And that's a different role for you.
Right now I'm working on a sweep. I love being on the street. I was out in the squad last week working on a crime story, and that's what I am. In fact, I thought I was going to have to cancel this today because I'm waiting on something, and but most of the time, about 90% of the time, I'm managing.
And you, do you ever miss the old, being on Hennepin Avenue? Do you ever miss just being on the beat in WCCO?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, I love it. And I keep up with a lot of it through my friends there. But whenever I miss it too much, I start thinking about winter. And I just, that last winter, I wore lined jeans, long clothes, heavy. I bought my best, heaviest coat ever. I don't think I can do the cold again. I've told people to come back to visit, but not between November and April. So don't schedule anything.
The dome collapse was your last winter here, correct? That was the snowfall dome collapses.
It was just brutal. And then it was not as bad until this one you just had past winter.
Right.
And I said the photographer, one of my favorites I worked with, but he'd start getting grumpy after the state fair because he knew winter was coming. It's almost like you could not totally enjoy fall as you brace for the cold weather.
Right.
Exaggerating a little bit, but I miss it. We're in an area where we don't have a whole lot of crime, relatively speaking, and when there's a really interesting crime story or some of the stuff that's going on with Jacob earlier in the year, some speculation on a potential suspect, that intrigued me. I still work with volunteers. I'm working on a search for Jody Huesinger, a thing called findjody.com, and several of us who have covered stories on her. One guy is a former police investigator. We talk monthly or every month. We go over things, hoping that by having this website, somehow, someday, we get some answers to what happened to Jody.
In that story,
in June, since she disappeared,
the Jody story from she was she in Mason City, Iowa, correct?
Yes, she was the morning anchor on her way to work.
That story had to hit close to, especially the media, and that was on stalking, and I believe, these are things that I had read and I watched when it happened, and I can't believe that we're almost 20 years later and we still haven't found what really happened. But
sure.
You see someone every day, and of course, she's a high-profile profile person in that area, and then she's gone, and no one knows anything that happened.
No, that's right. So, and it's disturbing. I'll look back at some of the old stories I did, and what am I missing? Is there something here? Is there some little piece of something? And I'm hoping now with the kind of things with forensics we have nowadays, internet, that maybe whoever it is might be looking at the website.
Right.
Or somebody, I interviewed a killer a number of years ago who had denied that he'd killed anybody, and then just before he died, he started confessing to a bunch of them, and In addition to that, another one that he'd never been linked to, I interviewed him in prison, and as much just to think what would get somebody to finally admit it. And I'm hoping that somebody knows what happened to Jody, what happened to Jacob and other missing people, and if they come forward.
I think we've found there's no sexual limitations into finding out the, you know, the solutions to, or finding out
to
what.
Not know.
Correct.
Yeah, I'd get on a plane tomorrow if I could come back and do the final chapter for you. You get close to their families and you just feel for them, and we go on with our lives, but they don't, you know, they always have that hole in their life.
Now, we discussed the Jacob Utterling item at length a couple weeks ago, and again, I think that I look forward to when you come back here to actually to report on the final conclusion to that mystery.
I hope it works. I mean, that would be my dream, would be to come back and have a part of that and just, you know, the last story, the last 2 weeks I was there, I did cold cases. I asked to go back, and CCO was gracious enough to let me just each day do a cold case revisit, and the very last one I did was on Jacob, and you know, spent the afternoon with Patty. It's just, it's hard. I mean, you do feel for them, and I think it makes you almost a little overprotective of your own kids. You know the odds are pretty small. I think when you've met a parent who's been through that, you never want to be there.
Well, you made a good point, you know, thankfully, in our guest today, Caroline Lowe, that due to the internet, due to the fact everyone has a handheld computer at their hands, it's going to be tougher for anyone right now. I mean, committing crimes is, on one end, I think internet crimes is, you know, rising, but, you know, the brutality of crimes and getting away with it, it's much tougher when someone's always recording someone, or there's always someone out there that can
everywhere. That's a big thing that's changed. Like the other day, I was on a story, and I couldn't get the photographer there in time, so I got my iPhone, and my iPhone video is pretty good. I don't shoot as well as he does, but when you have to, it's usable, and I've done stories that have led our newscasts with iPhone videos, and what a change.
There's 50 years of video and film on TCMedianow.com, and what's amazing is I know that the backs were broken by cameras of photographers that were carrying them around town, and right now there's a high definition camera that everyone has in their pocket now that can record, and it's amazing.
And you see them. I mean, they're brutal. I started them. We also had more crew. We had a sound person typically and a photographer. But you look at those big things they haul around. Our reporters here, they shoot their own stuff. They work a lot better climate, but they work a lot harder than I had. So I didn't shoot my own stuff, but they're smaller. And they love seeing how passionate they are still about being out there and informing the community and trying to make a difference and make it better.
Well, so our listeners, Caroline Lowe can still be featured on TCMedianow.com. You actually can watch her 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have a lot of newscasts from the 80s and 90s.
Did you have the one when they announced my son was born that was gone? I'll see if I have it. It was kind of fun. I was covering the Scott County sex trial, and I remember that morning I called in to say I went into labor a few hours later, and I called in to see who won the office pool betting because my son came 5 days early, and Colleen Needles came out and Brad Early and shot me with my son.
I don't have
and
the video,
was,
but
I was the first. And I was the first one. I was the first on-air reporter to have a baby. I'm told they would shoot me from the waist up because my goodness, she's pregnant. And then it became fashionable when the anchors started doing it.
You're a pioneer and innovator. And if you have the video, pass it on my way because I do not have the video online, unfortunately.
I'll see. Have you run into? I mean, I would think you'd have a lot of people wanting to contribute. So, and I'm going to go through. I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. I'm going to go through some of the things I've thrown in the box. I don't know if my kids will ever want it or not, but I think I'm at least going to scan the stuff in case someday they're interested.
Well, I'm hoping
some of the mom's old stuff.
What's tough for me is when I hear people that said, "Yep, I moved for the fourth time and I threw the box away and it's all gone," because that's what I have to my soapbox here. That kills me because there's so much history and so much video, and even especially with you on those crime beat stories, look at how Minneapolis has changed, and even the skyline or even, you know, Block E, which was notorious for crime, is now leveled. I get a lot of people get a lot of interest in what happened in the notorious you know Block E days or the Murdiapolis days. So don't throw your videos away. If anyone's listening today, don't throw the tapes away.
My main thing is I thought I was going to probably be there till I was 80, so I never really thought I had to save as many as I wish I had, but I'm going to go through, and it's fun to look at some of the old ads, some of the old posters. If you don't have them, they might be kind of fun to put on your sites.
Well, I look forward to that. Thank you so much for being on Flashback Twin Cities today. Caroline Lowe, currently at KSBY-TV, and if you want to see her, you can see her on tcmedianow.com, or you can see her work on ksby.com, correct?
That's right. We'll be posting a story in a couple of weeks. I get it all done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Carolyn Lowe of KSBY-TV, thank you. This is Tom Osmond. We'll be back next week here in Flashback Twin Cities. Till then, have a great Thanksgiving, and we'll see you soon.